Because when you really become a son of God, inherent in that is the fact that you have also become a brother of all of God's creatures. And then you can have freedom of choice. Yes. Because you're not going to hurt anyone.
Isn't this will on the two levels that Bert's talking about completely, not completely, but actually foreign to mind, since it stems from personality? And we're talking about mind.
We can make
this off into some other
mind place. Works in that arena.
We can make choices within the framework of time, space, and experience, the present time, relatively free choices. Our choice pro or con concerning God is probably an absolute choice. We got that from God. We have that prerogative. But except for that, all of our choices are relatively free, temporal, spatial, and experiential. On the absonite level, we're going to be able to choose outside of time and space, but not outside of experience.
More things. We're going to have a larger field.
It's a greater scope, I think. Here. Michael himself exercises free will in the present universe age within the limits decreed by the architects of the master universe. His creatures in Nebadon exercise free will within the limits planned by Michael, because it says he set the Lamanandex up with a greater range of choice than is customary. This is a further abridgment of the range of choice, not the fact of choice, but the range of choice. The basic framework is set by the architect. In Nebadon, it's further set by Michael. It's a frame within a frame. Not even a creator son can choose outside of the range of choice decreed for the architects of the master universe pertaining to the affairs of the present universe age. The architects can choose and plan within the framework which God decreed when he planned the master universe. And when they come to the end of the master universe, I think the architects are fresh out of plans. They've shot their wad.
Pretty good plan.
Yeah. They discuss this in their talk about primary and secondary causation. God sets up primary causation. In our series, the architects establish secondary causation. Michael establishes tertiary causation, and we operate within those three frames. God's choice, the architect's decisions, Michael's plans. And here's our framework. But again, there's a lot to do. I like the comparison of poker. Heredity says, you have no choice about this. Heredity says, there are 53 cards in the deck. The Joker is wild and ace of straights and flushes. It's draw poker. You didn't have a darn thing to do with this. Environment deals you a hand. You don't have anything to do with this. Ah, but then you start to play poker, and you have a great deal to do with what happens from there on out. This to me is a good example of the exercise of free will within a framework. Play poker.
Folks, I've got to go.
See
you about see all of you tomorrow at 55 as a dyer. Won't be.
Won't Clyde be there tomorrow?
I don't know.
We'll talk about him.
You know what happened? Nothing.
Good.
I've got a man's amount of work yesterday.
Take care of
Are you leaving because there's not enough cards in there?
That to me is a real crude but a very understandable illustration of what you control, what you don't control, and by golly, how you play.
Now,
I understand it.
I want to ask you a little more about this game. Would an absentized being be one that dealt the cards?
No. We're all down here on the finite level. We're working within the third frame, Michael's frame. Michael's frame was Michael's frame was further conditioned by the plans of the life carriers, which set up the original gene pattern down here.
But I don't think I'm absentized beings down here.
No.
He's not in this particular poker game.
Oh, I see what you mean. As far as I'm concerned, Bert, you're making my thing go on all fours now.
Yeah.
No, it's already beautiful. I just wondered if we could have another game.
Let's talk about the deal of the cards. It's a better illustration because there you've got chance.
Right.
See, this is a chance pattern that's set up here. One of my factors was a fixed pattern, whereas actually it's supposed to be both have a random element in it. The lottery of the genes is pretty well determined by the steeplechase of the sperms. I mean, the gal has got her mind made up. She's got a gene pattern in there. She doesn't have two. But then they turn loose a couple of 100,000 polywogs, and gee whiz, heaven knows which one gets there. If the one that started me off had been another split second later, I might have been a redhead, you know? And just real mean, instead of rich.
You might have been a redhead and mean instead of rich.
Yeah, I might have been a completely no good guy, but only partly.
Might have been a humiliation.
Both these factors are variables. In my poker illustration, the fixedness. Well, you could make a dealer's choice.
I appreciate that story, and I think it's good, and I'll withdraw my question.
I will.
Yeah.
Give
me two.
Sure.
You inherently want to clobber something up. You used to do. Beautiful story on a finite level. This was sweet mortal. Yeah, I like it very much.
Don't you know she lived on the astronaut level?
Damn if I don't believe it.
Well, that's why we appreciate her so.
What's that?
I don't know if you answered my question. Well, let's have it again. Give it. Burke wouldn't let
him.
Thought it just. But, you know, you talked about a while ago that you didn't think that Paris would be the fourth C, Carla. They were wearing that.
I think they're neutral about her.
Or how strong or how weak or when it happened. Then they don't foresee that English, you know.
Oh yeah, I think they've got a better weather department than we do.
But well, they would know then.
I don't think they're concerned.
Do that rub and come there at that time and kill and drown nine people and well, that's what I wanted to know.
I don't.
In other words,
they have a different yardstick than.
I'm sure they do, but I just want to know if they were using it.
I think they know. They said they could turn it out to my favor, but they're using it. They said they could know, but they didn't know that was for sure if they knew that. That's the way I interpreted it. And I wanted to know if they'd use any other city. If they are, why, I'll have
trouble with
that anymore. If they know it's inevitable,
I just don't think they interfere.
I know they do. I'm sure of that too. I'm convinced that that's right. I think they know that everything is. I mean, God, I should say, knows everything
sure
that's going to happen.
But he doesn't tell everything.
But he doesn't influence it. I mean, we don't have to do it. And it doesn't have any bearing on what we do. But how would you present it to newcomers? say, well, I can define by Webster omniscience and let go of that.
He makes his sun shine on the just and the unjust alike. Jesus recognized
what it. What if they say, well, now I know a good soul has got run over?
Let's talk about two men falling from a mountain height. One's a saint and one's a sinner. God could succor either or both by simply suspending the law of gravitation. He doesn't suspend the law of gravitation. The only time, Van, I think they interfere, and they do, is never for the person. Sometimes for the project. Twice they intervened in Peter's life. But when Peter had accomplished his ministry, the same people who intervened stood by and watched Peter die. It wasn't Peter, it was his mission. Otherwise, they'd be more than fair to Peter. No one intervened when they nailed Jesus on the cross. But Jesus never let himself get nailed on the cross until he had accomplished his mission. Then he just stopped manipulating things and let events catch up with him, which they swiftly did within a week. If he hadn't wanted to die that week, just using human resources, he'd have probably hogtied the Sanhedrin once more. God knows he hogtied them enough.
Well, God would know all about this. Many times he might resist them and everything. Even though that we might say, well, Jesus had the will to do that. And he did. And he could use it again.
Yeah.
But if he did, God would know all the time that he would come to it anyway.
The time had come.
I know that's right.
In the language.
Would God know of all those steps?
Oh, sure.
He made.
The fact that he could
prolong it.
Yeah.
And he could do this.
Yeah.
God knew in advance.
Certainly.
That he was going to do that.
What level are we on?
We're going to stay right here and get Bert to take care of Billy.
On the time-space level, I would answer that no. No. It was an adventure which God was observing through his personalized adjuster. On the transcendental level, yes. In the same sense that Michael's mind knew that Ezra was the father of five children, but Joshua ben Joseph's mind didn't. Look, when Michael accepted his bestowal commission, he was told to make no writings on permanent materials. The human Jesus did not remember this, and he made writings on smooth boards that hung around the house. When the two minds finally got together out in the 40 days, the first thing Jesus did when he went back to Nazareth was to destroy those boards. He remembered the details of his instructions. And that's two levels of consciousness. Michael knew this all the time. Jesus didn't. During the time of the tomb, the human Jesus was totally unconscious. just as unconscious as Lazarus was during his time in the tomb. But Michael communicated with several people in the local universe during this time. Michael wasn't unconscious, but the human Jesus was unconscious. And the human Jesus returned to consciousness when in Marantia form he emerged from that tomb before the stone was rolled away. I find it most helpful to think about levels of consciousness in Jesus, because Michael's divine mind is in some ways somewhat analogous to the divine mind of the thought adjuster in man. We have levels of consciousness, then. We have a conscious mind. I think we have a subconscious mind. I think we have a superconscious mind. And I would posit one more, a mid-mind between the whole globe of human consciousness and the adjuster. And I think the mid-mind is the mind of the soul. I visualize a human mind. Again, I gotta get simple symbols. I visualize a two-hemisphere planetarium. Have you all been in a planetarium?
No. I'm not a part of me.
All right.
Well, clear,
well, how drunk were you?
With or without wine?
Those synapses that I was telling me a while ago was working on me and then put me away.
Well, a planetarium is a great big hemisphere. And
look that way.
I wish you could visualize being inside of a double hemisphere, a globe. And there's a platform right bang in the middle. And it's a big circular platform. I've used this illustration before. And I think there's a searchlight on that platform. I think it's got a traverse of about, let's say, a certain number of degrees up and down. Now, to simplify things, let's think of this globe as just like the Earth. Same zones in it, only it's on the inside instead of the outside. And I think the searchlight, if you just don't move it up or down, goes right around the equator of this globe. Or you can lift it up or run it down a little bit, and you can put a spotlight anywhere in the torrid zone. Anywhere between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. Now, wherever that spotlight is, there is your consciousness. And below the bottommost reach is mind as it impinges on mammalian mind. I think the lower adjutants are down there. And I think here's where the sewer of the mind is. Or have you dreamed lately? You know, you can dream the darndest things. And it's real sewage. And it's seeping up. It's a lot of junk that you've suppressed. I think in the northern regions of this globe, we have the superconsciousness, where there is a down seepage that's good, true, beautiful. The great dreams of mankind, the great ideals of mankind, seep down from the northern hemisphere until one day you happen to hit them, pick them up with a spotlight, and you become aware of a new idea. This is the birth in consciousness of a new idea. I think the mid-mind is located, impinges on the North Pole. And to keep our simile, it's in touch with the thought adjuster above it. There's an awfully crude, but I think helpful, diagram of mind. It's a globe. And you can move a spotlight around a little north, a little south of the equator. And wherever that light shines, there is your consciousness at this moment. I can swing my spotlight. I'm going to think back to having lunch with Bill and Mary Kay last Thursday. We're sitting up in the Chaparral Club, right up against the window. Took a little bribery to get us there. And we're looking at downtown Dallas and way across the plains at Fort Worth. I can see that right now. I'm sitting here, Mary Kay's sitting there at the window, and Willie is right across from me. I can remember what we had for lunch. Kind of taste it again if I wanted. I'm swinging my spotlight.
Well, I can tell my conscious mind, I mean, what's happening in space right now. That's better than what you see.
Yeah.
And you can get back because you've seen it.
Sure.
That time. But I always talk about the things that, would happen in advance.
What
wrong.
The father would know.
Yeah.
Well.
Well, God, that's the one I had reference to. He gets off on thought adjuster and the mind conscious. But I just, you know, a while ago, and you used, I think, an illustration about Jesus knowing all those, to me, isn't, I think I'm following you just fine. but I think.
I think Mike Ilford knew that he was going to die that week in Jerusalem.
Well, I think...
I think Mike Ilford knew with complete certainty, and I think Jesus knew with extreme probability. I think there was a difference in the degree of certainty between Mike Ilford's knowledge and Jesus' knowledge. But I think Jesus is a human being. Had an extraordinarily accurate appraisal and forecast of the probable events.
How about the universal problem? Yeah.
It says he knows the end from the beginning.
Well, that's what we're at. In other words, if the Khrushchev decided to
blow the joint to hell,
and kill millions of people.
Yeah.
He decided the month before that he was going to do it. I think they'd be well aware of the midwares and the archangels and all of them would know it.
I think the father knew
it. Well, sure he'd know it.
The father knew it.
What was that?
And he was using Jesus. More than mine there, I think that he was, of course, he was so adjusted that he could foresee things that we can't foresee or predict.
I think
we can predict a lot of things.
If they don't know what religion about, how does reflectivity work?
Then I think in the super universe, they can forecast with uncanny precision. Not with absolute precision, but with what we would call uncanny precision. I think if they really wanted to forecast a horse race down here on Earth, they could sit out and gather their data and feed it.
You're talking about something else, man. I'm talking about it's going to be horses down here. We'll say, when the horse race ever got together, before they ever got a track.
Let me answer your question.
Back before the horses even pulled, we're going to win the race.
In my understanding, Van, as I understand it, there are only two sacred things here on Earth: the individual human being and the human race. And I would equate the statement of the human race to human germplasm, because that's what the race springs from. I don't particularly think our friends care about the survival of any cultural group or any particular nation. These are not of supreme value. I don't think they're going to let the human race be exterminated. I'm positive of this, because when a planet is threatened, they depopulate it and move it. Once the life carriers set life going and they breed men, they do not let this die out. But I don't think they particularly care how many millions of people might die if men are that foolish. Because if they intervene, then they abrogate free will. And if they abrogate free will, they are working contrary to the Father's will. Now, before this planet was, God knew its destiny at the transcendental level. And this has nothing to do with God's adventures in time and space through his fragments. These are bona fide adventures.
Well, I'll withdraw my statement, Bill. I've already gotten my answer, and you're elaborating on something else. I enjoy it very much. But it has nothing to do what I asked you. I just cannot ask a question properly, evidently, but I've already got my answer. You ought to give it to him.
The thing, I tell you, Van,
really
the horse race has been over.
He's on the same.
The horse race was over a long time ago.
He's on the same.
Van, look.
Now,
a guy by the name of Calvin answered that question simply and came up with a horrible doctrine of predestination. And it's so bad, it's so bad a doctrine, it approaches the atonement doctrine in its horribleness. And I always think of the Scotch Presbyterian minister that was preaching about predestination. And he kind of was ashamed of the theology. And he said to the congregation, of course, he says, you know that the Almighty has to do certain things in his official capacity which he wouldn't stoop to do as an individual. You see, according to predestination, babies that die at a year of age or 5 years of age are either predestined to survive or damned to hell. And of course, if you are a good Presbyterian with considerable conceit, you know that you're one of the elect. See, how do you know? Well, you just know, see. And since you're one of the elect, you've got nothing to worry about. You've got it made. But I don't think in time and space it's black and white. I think it's very uncertain. And what level is God working on? If God foreknows on all levels that Joe Dokes is not going to survive, then bestowing a thought adjuster upon him is a mockery. This means that this cannot be foreknown on the finite level. And this adventure takes place on the finite level, and it's a real adventure without living in it. And that adjuster comes out here with no foreknowledge of the fate of Joe Dokes. And that adjuster works heroically for the salvation of Joe Dokes. And as far as Joe Dokes is concerned, God's foreknowledge might just as well be neither fact nor truth. This is a bona fide test of Joe Dokes. The Father knows beforehand that you cannot make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. So does the thought adjuster, who probably comes down in that circumstance with the hopes that they will try to fabricate a pigskin pocketbook. This is feasible. This is within the range of possibility. Now, Calvin gave direct and simple answers to that question. I think Calvin is for the birds. Much as I like Presbyterians, this particular bit of theology was a step backwards. What level are we on?
Well, I think that's a good point, too. The thing where you lost me again was that whenever you said you didn't know whether it's going to be red or black or what color race it's going to be.
Oh, I haven't the least notion. Maybe the Patagonians, for all I know.
Well, I thought you said a while ago that God knew everything, and
now.
But I don't.
Well.
Listen, listen, Van.
All right.
Van, look. On the first level of the firehouse, they don't know.
Well, I got the idea.
They do not know.
When you said that the thought of Guster, you're too intelligent to come down here and start a losing battle, which would indicate
a hopeless battle.
They don't foreknow it.
I don't think they do. I think they know.
It makes no particular difference to me because I think that whatever God's plan is satisfactory anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he did know, and the fact that he doesn't interfere with my will, it has no influence on me.
No.
Well, and Bill,
you're on your own with help.
Now that if he says gets down to level in explaining the twins, we're going to get back in the same situation we did. Because it starts out saying God knows all things. The thing that brought that other one up is that God is everywhere present.
Sure. What's more, if you, Van, if you go on the second level of the firehouse or above, God not only foreknows, he always is known. It's not a question of when Khrushchev makes up his mind. When God created Havona, he knew Khrushchev. If you want to look at it that way.
But on this level here, he doesn't interfere at all. You don't,
no.
You think he'd have to be on the second floor. Then.
I don't think he knows on the first level. Any more than the human Jesus knew where they put Lazarus.
Well, I think that now there's a good analogy. I can understand that one.
He couldn't know, and he didn't know.
Well, when you said Michael knew, I kind of got the idea you meant that God knew.
I think God knew.
Well
that's a present event.
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it
is. On the first level of the firehouse, this is an honest to God adventure, mm-hmm. with the outcome unknown, mm-hmm. unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
now, when you start talking about what God is like outside of time and space, you're talking about something that really has no meaning in time and space. Because that's where we live.
Well, I wanted to get a clear picture of it.
Van wanted facts, didn't you, Van?
Well, I wanted facts
but facts can be untrue.
Well, that's right.
To say that matter is just as real as spirit is a fact. To say that matter is as real to man as his spirit is not true. Because man's progress towards reality is away from matter and toward spirit. On the material level, there is nothing for man but death. On the spiritual level is life eternal. But factually, matter is just as real as spirit. The Isle of Paradise is just as real as is the eternal sun. But it's not as real to man in his evolutionary experience of the universe. We will someday love the eternal sun, and we will look at him as a more comprehensible manifestation of the universal Father. We will know, use, enjoy, and admire the Isle of Paradise. We will live there, but we will never love paradise. Neither will we worship. We'll worship the eternal sun as the prime manifestation of God. It is a fact that God foreknows on some level, but it is not true that on our level he foreknows the outcome of our adventure. He is adventuring legitimately with us.
Well, the only thing that confused me, I wasn't following you on what level you were
seeking. We're talking about the first level of the firehouse.
You would agree with my thinking, and the next time you lose.
Well, what level of the firehouse are we on?
Well, on the first floor.
Right. All right, remember that the pole is on the first floor. God, as I know him, my Father in heaven, does not know whether I'm going to survive or not. God, on a transcendental level, obviously, is beyond time, hence can look accurately into the future as into the past. I've tried to illustrate my own forecast of the probabilities of the success of a human being, and our batting average is commercially acceptable. This has nothing to do with the free will choice of that man, though. But if they've got a sow of the year and they want to make a pigskin pocket book out of it, I can pretty well forecast that the operation is going to be unsuccessful. But that doesn't mean we have to throw the sow of the year away. It's got a value.
Well, yeah, but basically, protesters might have formed some opinion about the progress of an individual due to his background and everything. He knows all about that because that's factual.
Mm-hmm.
It's more or less been expressed. But he is willing to go down and try this stuff. But he knew that that fellow wouldn't make it. It'd be silly for him to come down.
Sure it would.
So
it's not known.
Cleared up now. I'm sorry that I couldn't explain what level that I had.
Think of the firehouse, then. I don't think they know on the first level. I think they
for
can
you,
do
when,
it.
When you use the word they.
God. The
seven God
on the first level of the firehouse. Any more than Jesus knew where Lazarus was. He didn't know.
Well, they give
no, no. Back on that, now Jesus was immortal and Joshua had been Joseph.
I'm using a comparison of two levels, both on the finite level. I think they have to forecast in the super universe. For example, they want to know how trustworthy we are. They don't know, just foreknow. They got to have access to a tertiary seconophim, the solemnity of trust. And this angel looks us over and then reflects to them a balance of our trustworthiness versus our potential for default. And then they put the proper load on us. They don't overload us. We can now carry 2.5 tons, so they give us a 2.5 ton load to carry.
Well, that brings out it more or less verifies the experimental planet, frankly. In other
sure.
words, how could they be experimental planet if they don't know in advance what they're going to do?
They don't out here.
So that's really good. Thing that kind of confused me. I couldn't understand how God could know everything on this level, on the first floor, and be an experimental planet. Why go through something they already know in advance? They know that we're going to have hurricanes and we're going to get killed walking in front of a car and all that. Why go through all that? To me, they've got it misworded.
Then, your father and my father loves it. Hopes for us, and we'll be honestly disappointed if we don't make it, and we'll be very gratified if we do make it. This, I think, on the first level of the firehouse, is a sincere adventure on the part of God. And beyond that, we're discussing God as we are not going to know him on paradise. This is for some future universe age. And on that level, I'm quite sure he knows the end from the beginning, and always has.
And that's what they're describing in these first pages.
Mm-hmm.
God,
I don't worship God the ultimate. I don't worship the Father as ultimate. I don't love the Father as ultimate. I recognize in my theology that he's there, I worship the Universal Father, who sent me my thought adjuster and who gave me my personality, and who wants me for a son. This is the God of love. This is not all of God. Common sense tells you that. But this is God in your experience and my experience. And that's quite enough for practical everyday living without falling into Calvin's damn foolishness. To me, that's the best attempt I can make to unscrew the inscrutable. And that's pretty much what we're trying to do with that. We're contrasting God on two levels.
Of course, I know, and everybody else here knows, that you can explain things well if the question is delivered properly. I never had the forethought to put it designate the level. I mean, I just thought by saying what he could he predict what we would do down here.
Then the God that you and I worship is a finite God, though our minds tell us he's more. We can't worship an infinite being. Even the universal censor says, I love the Father, Son, and Spirit. I honor and respect the deity absolute.
Well, to elaborate on further, we describe God's concern to we mortals as our earthly father, and it didn't hardly seem right that he would know
Jesus. Now, the personality who prayed in Gethsemane was not a all-conquering, ever-victorious Creator Son in His divine majesty. The person who talked about cups and drinking was a human being who hurt very badly, and the hurt was real. Otherwise, this is the damnedest fiction that was ever written. This man hurt. But no man, no mere man dying on a cross, could have showed the compassion for the chap alongside him. There you have love, both within the finite range, hence more comprehensible, but they serve to illustrate something of the levels of God. The humanity and the divinity of Jesus are separate levels. The Creator Son did not pray in Gethsemane. And something more than a man promised this chap he'd meet him someday in paradise. Then I don't understand too much about this myself. I simply know Calvin has got to be wrong. There's got to be a better explanation than Calvin. And I try to draw from the life of Jesus analogies to probe into the reality of God. It's safer to go from the more understandable to the less understandable. If Jesus could pray as a man and still be a Creator Son, and then as a Creator Son transcend himself as a man, then to me it's a little easier to understand how God can adventure on one level and on another level foreknow the outcome. This has nothing to do with the reality of the adventure on the level on which you and I live, die, and search for God. And the God that we will find is the God of the adventure, not the God who foreknew. That's another level of the same being. You can know and understand Joshua ben Joseph. We can hardly understand the divine Christ, can we? We can worship him as a portraiture of God, but to understand him, no. But the human Jesus, Lord, he's understandable. He's fun. He would be a great guy to know. But I wouldn't say those, make those statements about the divine Christ. Does that help?
It sure did help. It helped a lot. I just didn't make myself clear.
Are you satisfied?
It sure did help me a lot.
This is a paradox in human experience because we know only one level, see? But I think someday we will become conscious of two levels. And then I think it'll be much more understandable. When we're fused with our thought adjusters, I think in essence we'll be two-level beings. One level has got an existential memory going back into past eternity, which the other level can only comprehend as it develops capacity. If a finaliter should meet a bestowal son, a creator son. Say Jesus. I don't think that finaliter could really fraternize with a Master Michael as a unified being. Let me suggest a fanciful concept to you. Let's say that the finaliter could, since he's a two-level being, could polarize himself, could dissociate his two levels as much as is possible within the limitations of a fused being. Then I could see how he could fraternize. The humanity of the finaliter could fraternize with the humanity of the bestowal son. And the divinity of the finaliter, the adjuster end, could fraternize with the creator divinity of that same son. Otherwise, it would be a relationship of a creature to a creator. They could have a relationship with the finaliter as a unified being, but to fraternize, to be chummy, I think the finaliter would have to do something like polarize. Then I think he could do it. They'd be working on two levels. Because Michael is still human. Human on three levels, as a matter of fact. Don't forget his fifth and sixth bestowals was as an ascending mortal. He has a rich endowment of humanity. And if we could get just that part of him, we could fraternize with him just as much as the little children did when he was in the carpenter shop and they said, Uncle Joshua, come out and tell us a big story.
Well, you sure have cleared that for me,
Bill. I cleared it up for myself. Then there's got to be, you've got to work on levels, I think. Otherwise, it's a fiction. It's silly. There is no adventure. And yet, there obviously is an adventure. Experience tells you that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense when you explain how the thought adjustment would be, too. You know, just go along with that. What's the name of the brass rod that runs clear on from the bottom of the third floor clear on into the ground?
That's the Universal Father. That's God.
So the Universal Father.
He's real and all.
He's all knowing.
Right. And what's more, that
once
breath
you get
rod,
out of that realm, that's where Bert wants to know if I'm satisfied. Sure.
That brass rod goes through the ceiling.
And right on out.
And the floor of the third floor. And that brass rod goes on up as far as you can see.
And
in
the name of that brass rod is the Universal.
That's the name which we have given to the brass rod on the first floor.
We kind of call
it the same
God.
Rod.
We kind of usually just give an umbrella name, God.
That's the most general name
we
have.
On this planet.
Yes. God is not a father on the second floor. He's something else. He sustains a different relationship to transcendental super personalities. A father creates, but on the second floor, I think he eventuates. I speculated about a cellar. I don't quite know where the adjusters come from. Maybe from the third floor. Listen, Van, this is a rough question. It trapped a very smart theologian by the name of Calvin. And it's bothered Christian theologians ever since the days of Calvin.
Well, we had discussed that, and I got the impression it wasn't too important, and probably isn't too important if we
what we think is the will of the Father. But if you say that God knows everything, and he foresees and he predicts what he predicts, but I'd say if you say foresees danger before it happens, you might jar somebody, and it might not even be the truth, and I get the idea that it's the truth. Now, he can predict what might happen, but I don't get the idea that if he wanted to predict. But I get the idea that he doesn't actually know. He has a form of opinion.
On the first floor, he's been.
On the first floor.
And then, Van, don't forget this. The difference in perspective. If Jesus had not been Jesus, and John's heralded mission had been something different, and let's say that we were followers of Bar Kokhba, who led the last great Jewish revolt against the Romans. And John had functioned as a recruiting officer to get this stirred up. And we'll say, here's Bar Kokhba there. And Herod's got him in Nicaria's fortress. You know what we'd have done. We'd have stormed the darn place and liberated him. And many of Jesus' followers, especially John, Judas was bothered with this. Why didn't Jesus do something? Jesus had foreknowledge in the sense that he knew John's future. Jesus knew that John had accomplished in the world that for which he was born. His mission was fulfilled.
Would you say John was hinging on the second floor of those at that
time? No. No, he was just in jail, that's all. Now, Jesus didn't tell him to talk nasty about Herod and get himself in jail. That was John's doing. And Herod threw him in the hose cow. Jesus knew the future that lay ahead for John. And knowing that future and seeing the almost seamless continuity of this life, the mansion world, John's function on the board of planetary directors, he's chairman of the board.
Well, let me interrupt here a minute. Couldn't he foresee his future by his past life? You know, the fact that he had to live the will of God, he had no disharmony with God, he could see that.
That's
God
right.
Could see that.
Jesus knew John was going to survive.
Right. But that's reason, and since he had all those qualities, he knew what was for him.
Yes. Now, that being the case, Jesus' attitude toward John in jail was totally different from the attitude of his followers. And the thought of John's death was not disturbing to Jesus, as it was to his followers. You see how Jesus' perspective made him appear to be callous and indifferent to John, and he wasn't. And John knew this. When his superconscious leaked a little extra,
finally,
and he blew his stack in jail and told his followers to mind their own business and follow Jesus. And when he finished talking, John perceived he had uttered a prophecy, which is to say, new and better truth had come to him in his adversity. And soon John was dead.
That was way late.
Now, looked at from a purely human standpoint, if John is the herald of Bar Kokhba, and we are his paratroopers, and we're going to drive the Romans into the sea, a very patriotic feeling. Let's get the English out of the country, you know, and set up shop. We wouldn't act that way at all, because our kingdom would be of this world, and we would make John an objective. And we'd storm Macarius Fortress and give Herod what Patty gave the drum. And as an ex-Marine, it sounds exciting. You know what I mean? But this wasn't Jesus' purpose. When you stop and think of Jesus' attitude towards John, then you can see how our celestial supervisors here on earth look at many of the catastrophes which bother our minds. I don't think they think Carla is particularly important. And whether, Van, look, I'm going to fly home Monday. I don't think these folks particularly care whether I'm on a creaky plane or a good plane, as far as me personally am concerned. And whether I strike out for the mansion world next week, next year, 10 years from now, in the light of the next million years is not important, is it? Think of a child. Mommy, I want a doll. I want that doll. I want it now. Hush, honey, Christmas is next week. But I want it now, Mommy. I want it now. Mommy knows that the doll is home. Already, a duplicate wrapped in the Christmas package for little Sally. But Mommy, I want it now. Yeah. That's the way we are. When you look at a child, you can get the perspective. Whether our lives are long or short, man, I don't think is of great importance to God. It's what we do with what time we have.
I'm sure of that. I have no doubt that I said that to somebody. There might be some people that are worried.
There are a lot of people that are going to worry.
The wrong thing when I say it, there are a few words anyway.
I would
just uttered one or two when that just didn't quite fit in with the teaching.
I would avoid this discussion with the freshmen.
I would.
The basic concept comes from
Egyptian. We're studying deity.
The basic concept comes from Egyptian morality. The Egyptians taught that if you were righteous, you would prosper. The Hebrews picked that up from them. And it's been a very pleasant thought ever since. The book of Job, to the contrary, notwithstanding. Do you recall those three vultures, Bildad, Eliphaz, and Zophar? Who looked at Job's boils, his decimated flocks, his troubles, and he says, you can't be virtuous. Your adversity proves that you're lacking in virtue. What a horrible way of looking at things. Now, if you've got it made, you can act awful smug and say, see, the Lord prospereth those whom he loveth. Tain't so. Rodin gives you the clue to prosperity. He said your virtues are not directly concerned with your prosperity. It's simply, are you camped along a stream where wealth flows or not? This is not a subject for prayer. This is a subject for human wisdom and judgment. But that's awful dangerous ground for a freshman.
Yeah, well, of course we're actually, it works at on deity level, but you know, we try to bring it down to this level.
I mean, we're studying deity.
I know it. Ben wouldn't argue with you on that, you know, although besides, you know, brought that down very nice. He had presented extremely well, I thought. Along with JB, the good ones too. But some of them, you know, they think on the finite level, on how we live here on the earth. And I just love to that. That I would express myself more because I have some misgivings, more or less, on how I would. What I was going to do with it, but now I know if it comes up that I might be able to elaborate on a little bit or throw a few words, because I just
why Helen?
Huh? Or Helen?
Well, No, I'm not going to bring it up.
One thing I'm convinced of, Van, God's not play acting. When it says that Jesus was tried and tempted as we are tried and tempted, and yet was found without fault, by damn that means what it says. Otherwise, it is a farce. And that means he had to be human at the same time that he was divine. That means Gethsemane was real, not a fake. And I don't think Mike Hill could have felt that way. But I can jolly well see how a Jew who loved his people and was being rejected by his people could have damn near had his heart broken. And Jesus was a real Jew, for all that he outgrew his parochialism and provincialism. He wept over Jerusalem, something no Gentile could have done. Let's quit.
Yeah, that's the whole. Somebody asked another question, would be here to live.
Lord.
Oh, I sure like the way Bill explains it.
Well, I want to tell you something. I didn't make all the notes I meant to make when I was on the transcendental level last week. But I sure am going to take more copious notes next time I pay it a visit.
And Everett, the next time that you give a discourse in absonancy, bring a few notes back with you.
Yeah.
Will you?
Yes, already.
Well, what do you mean, two or three?
If we have not reared the head, either two or three children on this planet, we have to serve time in the nursery school. Is it two children here or three children?
It says you have to have three children in order to act as judges.
On the commission,
Be on the commission. It doesn't say how many children you have to have in order to qualify for parental experience. I would say one would qualify you.
You think so? Well, that discussion come up.
It takes three children, though, to empower you to sit in judgment on your on the parental qualifications of your associates.
Three or more children.
And in this days, you have to satisfy the commission.
Sure.
They don't say how many you have to raise.
You may be a biologic parent, as are the case of many busy fathers, and you may not qualify as a parent. Mm-hmm. The mere fact you procreated a child. On the other hand, you may have had no children and have had the complete parental experience raising an adopted child or a niece or a nephew. Did you have the function of a parent? And this has little or nothing to do with biological parenthood. Now, it's my understanding that you have to have raised three children, not necessarily your own, for three children in order to function as a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as the rest of us are concerned, you satisfy the commission. Now, if you don't satisfy the commission and you've got a child on the nursery world, you can go over there and work off half your deficiency on the nursery world, but you still have to work off the other half with the atomizer.
But I don't believe it necessarily with your own child.
I would suspect it would be your own child. Why else would you go? Oh, I suppose you'd have to do with other children.
Well, if you didn't
for sentimental reasons, I think you'd certainly have to do with your own.
Well, what if your own isn't there? You don't have it.
Well, I
come to think of it, heaven's sake.
I suspect your own would be there, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're thinking in terms of 300 years
this
now.
This is a sentimental universe. If you're on Mansion World number 2 or 1, and you've got a pal, or a gal, or whoever it is, that you want to stay with, and he hasn't learned to do his spiritual KP yet, and he's got some deficiency credits to work off, they don't force you to go ahead. You can apply for a stay of advancement. They probably give you a junior teaching job. And, well, that's something for you to do. And you can wait while this buddy catches up. This is a real sentimental universe within limits. So I think it's if it's a parent with a child in the nursery world, sure, you'd be interested in any child, but wouldn't you have a particular interest in one of your own?
Which one of them?
Nursery world, it's in the Pinellas' world. This is the world around which the seven mansion worlds are moons. It's one of the satellites of Jerusalem. The seven mansion worlds are its moons.
Okay,
it's seven
moons. I read it and you at the time when I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. I also had a pretty picture, but this one.
I did very much.
If you look at the seven mansion worlds in relation to planetary mortal epochs, and it's a good way to look at them, then I think we ought to realize that the seven mansion worlds are an equalizing technique, so that no matter how long or short your life, no matter what the level of culture into which you're born, this evens the score. This is what you can't do when you look at human life and just say, look, it isn't fair. I had a brother who died when he was a year old. I had a son who died when he was 20. I'm 53. I don't think either of those persons had as much of an opportunity as I've had. And if I didn't know about the mansion world, I could be bothered. You know, as people are, well, if God is all-powerful and God is all-loving, then how come we have these inequalities in life? Now, with the mansion world, I can see how the inequities of mortal life, mortal culture, are all evened out. I suspect that our friend Ogwalla the Bushman, who makes it, and he can't count beyond many, and many is the next number after three. Now, he and Albert Einstein will say, wake up on the first mansion world. Well, now, Ogwalla has got to have a lot more arithmetic than Einstein's got to have. I imagine Einstein will place out by examination on considerable of the mathematics that they teach in the lower levels over there. But Ogwalla's going to have to go right to work on basic arithmetic and learn to count beyond three. And of course, think this is provided for. Let's take a person who, a real retarded person from the era of light and life, who might still be going through the mansion world, but who has got an intellectual culture far beyond anything we even dream of. A man alongside of which Albert Schweitzer would look kind of primitive, you know, a sort of a selfish, primitive type. This is equalized too. As you study the mansion world, you see that they compare with planets in different levels of culture. Will someone refresh me on how they jibe up? I haven't read that paper in a long time. We can find it easy enough. Let's just go back and refresh our memories. I think the first comparison is on about the third mansion world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the development on mansion world number two compares the intellectual status of the post-magisterial sun culture of the ideal evolutionary world. Well, the era before that is the post-Adamic. So I'd say number one would compare with the post-Adamic. And you aren't going to get off of one until you reach that level. The third mansion world then must compare, yes, with the nature of the post-bestowal sun age of a normal inhabited planet. And the fourth mansion world is like the post-teacher sun age. Now that means the fifth mansion world must represent the initial eras of light and life. Isn't it on Mansion World Number 5 that adjuster fusion usually takes place? Am I correct in that memory?
Right.
Let's just check that.
I think
yes, it's 6. It's number 6. Well, that would be farther advanced than light and life. And number 7 would be still farther advanced than light and life. So that as we compare our planetary mortal epochs, Mansion World Number 1 is like the first two planetary mortal epochs, pre-planetary prince and planetary prince.
Number 1?
Number 1. Number 2 is like number 1 is like the first 3. Pre-planetary prince, planetary prince, and post-Adamic. Number 2 is post-magisterial. Number 3, post-bestowal. Number 4, post-teacher sons. And number 5, 6, and 7, various stages in the era of light and life. So you see, the culture of these mansion worlds really kind of stretches. And post-Adamic. That has to be true because the next mansion world covers the next planetary mortal epoch, which
well,
is post-Adamic.
Well, number 5. Number 4 is number 6, isn't that right? The fourth mansion world is the post-teacher son.
Yeah. In the fifth mansion world, it would follow.
Post.
Involves the early ages of light and life. 6th, farther along in light and life. 7th, still farther along in light and life. Now don't get too far along in light and life because in the intermediate and advanced stages of light and life, you skip the mansion worlds entirely. You skip the mansion worlds entirely. In the intermediate and advanced stages of light and life, the average ascender wouldn't go to the mansion worlds at all. As you'll recall, when a whole local system is well established in light and life, the mansion worlds go out of commission. No more use for them. Everyone wakes up on Jerusalem direct, or even beyond Jerusalem, upon Edentia and even Salvation. And the mansion worlds are turned to an entirely different purpose, which we don't know anything about, except they tell us there are beings that haven't been revealed. Just as an example of beings that haven't been revealed, you'll recall that in each local system, there is a world called the Midsonite world. And here, instead of downstepping the Adamic race by blending it with the human, they upstep the Adamic race by blending it with the Melchizedek strain. And these folks are called Midsoniters, and I think that means mid-sons. They say they are immortal because they're not fused with any divine spirit. But they're not mortal because none of them has ever died. And they're pretty high-order beings. They're upstepped Adamites. Burke is what we call a downstepped Adamite. The rest of us are lower than that, see. And
I'm agreeing with him, man. He's authority.
Now, in a super universe, there are 1 billion local systems. Hence, there are 1 billion Midsonite worlds in a super universe. But if they left the story of the Midsoniters completely out of these papers, you would never miss it, would you?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they could have omitted all mention to 7 billion Midsonite worlds in the 7 super universes And you couldn't find the gap in here if it weren't here. If, as Clyde said, we tore those pages out of the book.
Makes you wonder how much there is missing.
That's my point, Wilma. How many other things have they left out? Now, the Mistoniters represent approximately 0.1% of a local system. But when you stop and think, 0.1% adds up to 7 billion such worlds in time and space. That's pretty big. 7 times as many worlds as they have worlds in Havona. I'll bet you there are a lot of other odd-type worlds floating around, just like Midsonite worlds. When you consider the life of a planet, I think we should note that ours is pretty different. On a normal world, on an average world, man seems to evolve by 7 independent mutations. That is to say, the red race is first, or 6 independent mutations, pardon me. The red man is first, and for a long time he's the only human species. And if it follows in the spectral colors, the orange race comes next, then the yellow, green, blue, and indigo. And these are independent mutations arising out of the animal forebears of man. The story of our world is very different. The story of our world, we got a pre-red race, a much earlier manifestation of human will. The Andonic race is atypical on the worlds of time and space. And the Andonites gave rise to the mutational appearance of the 6 colored races all in one generation in the Sangik family in the hills of Afghanistan, whence they spread all over the world. Yes, ma'am, they were. Our world has not had 7 races, we've had 9. We had the normal 7, 6 evolutionary, and the Adamites, that's par for the course. Then we had the pre-evolutionary colored people, the Andonites, and we had the Nadites. So we've had altogether 9 races of men here on Earth.
Well, we're an experimental planet.
That's right. And except for Burke, the Adamic strain is just too darn diluted.
They are, it goes on to tell us. You'll notice that these races segregate themselves.
Yeah.
By environment and one thing or another. But finally, we amalgamate in the one olive-colored race.
That's right. The whole principle of an early planet, the early history of the planet, is divergence. And as I studied this book, I think there is a principle of divergence-convergence. It's first expressed when you see, as it were, the white light of the Paradise Trinity prismatically broken up into the polychrome of the 7 Master Spirits. And if you liken the Trinity to white light, then the rainbow effect of the 7 Master Spirits, I think, is a good analogy. It's the components of white light. And then when that's refocused back together again, you get white light, only you don't get the Trinity, you get the Supreme Being. Because they refocus it on a finite screen. The white light of the Trinity, which spreads out into the rainbow of the seven master spirits, comes back together again in the white light of the Supreme Being. And very frankly, I think of Super Universe number one as red, and number two as yellow, and number three as blue. They're the primary colors. If I had to pick a color to symbolize Master Spirit number one, I'd pick the color red.
Well, would you pick the seven?
White, putting them all back together. Or black, either one. If you're mixing light.
White.
All right, this is bad semantics. If you're mixing light, you get white, and if you're mixing pigment, you get black. In studying planetary mortal epochs, pre-planetary prince man, you ought to read the paper on the inhabited world, because that pretty much is a discussion of the pre-planetary prince age, plus some other things. When you get to the, when you read the next epoch, or rather, when you read the dispensation of the planetary princes, read back into the paper on the planetary princes. The third era, the Adamic, post-Adamic epoch, is a paper on the planetary atoms. And of course, read forward in part three to see where our world departed from the north. Our world departed also because Calligastia didn't arrive for roughly a half a million years after the appearance of Andon and Tondon. You'll recall they appeared about a million years ago. It's a good round number. Sometimes the planetary prince arrives in the same generation of the mutation of the first human being. When he arrives, he's accompanied by quite an entourage, quite a retinue, including 100 corporeal assistants. These folks, you'll remember, are ascenders who've gotten through the mansion world, got to Jerusalem, haven't yet fused with their adjusters for some reason. And they volunteer to serve on the staff of a planetary prince for a whole dispensation. And they're reinvested with material bodies of flesh and blood. Would virtually have outnumbered the human race. There were less than 100 people alive, even when the grandchildren began coming along. And they died, and Donatana died before they had very many great-grandchildren. Why didn't they do that? Think what a head start mankind would have gotten had the arts of Dalmatia